Yiridoo Murrungmudgee. Hello, friends, and welcome to the very first episode of STEAM, where you can sit back, grab a cuppa, and stay up to date with all the latest happenings in science, technology, engineering, and maths. It's also a place where we look at the intersection of traditional knowledge and modern science and arts, and we speak to the people working in this space to find out what they're up to. Today, we're going to be finding out more about Sony's latest charity stream, a really cool event that's being put on by creators for Instagram, a new development for New South Wales Transport involving quantum technology, there's a really cool space archaeology project, and later in the episode, we're going to be chatting with Luke Briscoe from Indigilab about, among other things, the difference between Indigenous people doing science and Indigenous science, and why that matters. First up, Sony Foundation has kicked off its Gaming for Life charity stream, which runs until November 30. Melbourne creators, you can take part by streaming live from Australia's biggest video games venue, which is Fortress Melbourne. I spoke with Sony Foundation CEO Sophie Ryan about Gaming for Life and what it aims to do.
We're aiming to raise $50,000 through the stream. We'd just be really grateful for as many people as possible to jump on.
That was Sony Foundation CEO Sophie Ryan. There are Money Can't Buy prizes for people who watch the stream and donate. And if you donate $20 or more, you also have the chance to win a PS5. And considering how rare they are right now, I reckon it might be worth a shot. To register as a streamer or to watch, you just need to head to sonyfoundation.org/gamingforlife. I'll pop a link in the show notes for you as well. New South Wales is leading the world with an ambitious plan to use quantum technology to run the transport network, claiming to save travellers' time and potentially even lives. Deputy Premier and Minister for Regional Transport and Roads, Paul Toole, said in an unprecedented leap from current computers, quantum computing would process and analyse massive amounts of information almost instantaneously. That means we can more accurately track the location and capacity of a train or a bus. As part of this plan, Transport for New South Wales is establishing a centre of quantum technology that will be based in Sydney's Tech Central, and it will be co-led by a dedicated quantum technology director and a fellow of quantum technology. That centre will also draw on an expert advisory panel made up of pioneers from government, industry and university sectors, including 2018 Australian of the Year and University of New South Wales Professor Michelle Simmons. Transport for New South Wales is also seeking expressions of interest from global industry leaders, academics, and startups to help research, develop, and implement the quantum technology pilots and trials across the transport network. Industry briefing sessions will take place in the coming weeks, with a plan to award contracts and finalise co-investment proposals in early 2022. Not far away now. In an out-of-this-world study, space archaeologists are reconstructing life on the International Space Station over the past two decades. It's to better understand space culture and to get an inside look at how astronauts interact above Earth. I spoke with internationally recognised space archaeologist, Associate Professor Alice Gorman from Flinders University, about this project.
I'm an archaeologist who applies my skills to the objects that humans have put into space.
Amazing. And you're currently working on a project that's reconstructing life on the International Space Station over the past 20 years or so. Why is this important information to have?
There's a few reasons why we need to know more about the International Space Station, which you would think we already knew everything there was to know about, but surprisingly, no. From an archaeologist's perspective, the first thing is that the International Space Station has an end of life. So probably somewhere towards 2030, it's likely to be deorbited.
Oh, wow.
So it's going to come to an end, and it's the only permanently occupied space station that we've ever had in Earth orbit. So it's a unique lifestyle. And as an archaeologist, I and my collaborators want to know what makes it distinct. How do people use objects to adapt to life in microgravity and to life in space? So it's like our last chance to really get a handle on how a new kind of society has been created in Earth orbit. But there's more to it than that. So this is very contemporary stuff, obviously. People are used to thinking of archaeology as being about very ancient places.
Yeah.
But what we're working on here is something that's contemporaneous with us. So this means what we find out by using archaeological techniques to look at how the crew interact with their environment is we can find out things that can be used to design better space habitats in the future. So there's actually quite a practical purpose to having a look at how the crew live everyday life on the station at the moment.
Well, that makes a lot of sense when you think about, you know, all of the people that are talking about colonizing Mars and other parts of the solar system. This would probably be good information to have.
I think so. And no one's done an archaeological approach before. Plenty of studies, of course. So they have designers and engineers and psychologists and even sociologists who are all studying everyday life in space. But what makes archaeology different is that we're really interested in the little patterns and routines of interactions with objects. And we've already found things that even NASA didn't know.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. We were quite astonished. So there's a wall on the Russian Zvezda module of the International Space Station where the crew have stuck up pictures ever since the station was first inhabited in 1998.
Oh.
So everybody knows the pictures are there, but what they didn't know until we documented and then statistically analysed them was that the combination of pictures changes over time. And there's a lot of icons, Russian Orthodox icons, that are stuck up there, and their appearance isn't random. It's actually linked to events back in Russia. And nobody knew this, and it was only when we did that. I mean, it was a fairly small study because it's only a little space, and I think there were 75 items up there, but nobody knew this. So that's the kind of thing that archaeology could find out.
Amazing. And, you know, travelling to the International Space Station is probably out of the question for you personally to do this research. And unless it is, then wow. But how are you planning to tackle it if you can't be there yourself?
Well, I suppose I'm always holding out the hope that one of those space billionaires will decide to fund space archaeology, but I probably shouldn't hold my breath on that one. It's a bit of an obstacle. So it's so expensive, millions and millions of dollars to go to the International Space Station. And, you know, archaeology funding doesn't produce that kind of money. So we've had to think of some different ways to actually get the data. And one of those is by using the photographic record that starts from 1998 and goes right up to the present. So the crew on the station have been photographing what they do every day for that whole 20-year period, and they're digital photographs. And what makes this interesting is that we can use the metadata, the time and locational information embedded in that digital photograph, to kind of reconstruct chronological stratigraphy, just as if we were excavating layer by layer down into the earth on a traditional archaeological site. So we're developing machine learning methods that can see the patterns in how crew members use different kinds of objects. So we can map how they change over that 20 years. So that's one way we're getting over the obstacle of not actually being able to go into space and excavate.
Are you also using, you know, some of the astronauts that are currently up on the International Space Station? Are they involved in any way?
Crew time to do experiments on the ISS is also very, very expensive. But we were very lucky because due to a combination of factors, this year and next year, they've actually got some spare time for experiments. Usually it takes, you know, years to kind of get an experiment together and get it in the queue, then actually get it up into the space station. But we are going to be, well, I say flying an experiment. It's not like we have some kind of, I don't know, cube full of stuff that we're going to put onto the International Space Station. Our archaeological experiment is asking the crew to do an archaeological survey that samples different areas in the station to see what objects are there over time. And again, we're going to use digital photographs to do this. So the good thing about this is the crew have to do experiments all the time. Like, that's their main work up there. And they're frequently in areas that they have no specific training in. So they're very, very good at following a precise set of instructions or a protocol and not changing anything or not thinking, oh, maybe it'd be better if I did this this way or whatever. So they're very professional and good at doing that. So we're sending them up instructions on how to set out, like if they were on Earth, we might call them test pits. So a little systematic sample of different locations to find out what's there. So they're going to mark out on the walls of the station 1 by 1 meter squares in tape and photograph the squares the same time every day so that we can see the objects that are the highest in frequency at that particular location, how frequently the objects change, and we'll start to see an aspect of these daily routines that has been unrecognised up until now. So this is going to take place in January. At the moment, we're constantly in meetings to try and arrange all the practical details. It sounds simple, and I'm glad, I guess, it's not more complicated because there's so much involved, but there is a lot of planning involved in getting this to work. And in January, fingers crossed, January 2022, the crew are going to become space archaeologists in their own right and carry out what will be the first ever archaeological survey actually in space. So we're super excited.
It would be absolutely incredible to be able to see all of these photographs in one place in like an exhibition or something sometime in the future.
Ray, that's quite a brilliant idea. We might have to think about that. There's many parts of the space station that they're kind of aesthetic in their own style. And people often think of space stations like in 2001, A Space Odyssey, and you've got this kind of beautiful, hyper-modern, clean, lean, white interior. And the actual International Space Station is actually quite a messy place with stuff everywhere.
Oh, no.
But that's what we want, though. We want to find out what that stuff does. And these photographs are going to be showing all these different little objects, kind of focusing on them. So things, when you look at a picture inside the ISS, you might be looking at what the astronaut is doing, or there might be, you know, some interesting piece of equipment or an experiment they're doing. We're interested in that stuff too, but we're actually interested in things like, where are the Ziploc bags? Where are the scissors? They use scissors for a whole range of things. And patches of Velcro, that kind of stuff, the kind of stuff that seems trivial at one level, but actually a really vital part of adapting to microgravity. Anyway, coming back to your exhibition idea, I really love it and I think we should do it.
I think we should too. Let's see who we need to talk to get it started. I'm keen. But I'd love for you to also tell me about, you know, the things on the International Space Station that come back to Earth, because, you know, not everything stays up there forever. You've just described a quite messy, almost chaotic environment, really. So I imagine when they don't need things anymore, there's a bit of decluttering happening. Why are the things that come back to Earth important to take a look at as well?
Well, we think of the things that come back as it's a sort of a discard process. So on your traditional archaeological site, everything that's left behind for the archaeologist to excavate has been discarded in some way, whether it was broken or used or exhausted or abandoned. It's been left there by someone. So we're always looking at objects not as people use them, but afterwards when they've been discarded. So my collaborator, Justin Walsh, is at Chapman University in California, started thinking about the return of stuff from the International Space Station as a form of discard and what it might say about the values attached to the objects that come back. So we started having a look at this process, and he actually was able to go and watch the cargo deintegration crew, as they call it, actually unpacking a Dragon cargo vehicle that returned to Earth. So there's a whole bunch of stuff they use up on the station that's very disposable. So wet wipes, they use them for cleaning the station surfaces. Ah. They use, they're disinfected, the cleaning ones, but they also use them to clean themselves because it's not possible to have a shower.
Of course.
So they've got a huge quantity of these used wet wipes. And they don't come back. What happens to them and a whole lot of other rubbish like food packaging is that they're put into an automated vehicle that's sent to burn up in the Earth's atmosphere.
Oh, of course.
So the stuff is destroyed. Then there's all of the experiments and the samples and stuff related to the work that the crew do, and that's sent back to Earth so it can then go back to the laboratory or the research institution or the university who commissioned the experiment and is going to continue the analysis. So that stuff's treated. That's the, you know, one of the main purposes of the station. So that stuff is treated with incredible care. And then you have other things like the personal objects that belong to the crew. They can only take a little bit of their own personal things up there. It's a very limited amount, and they can only send a limited amount back. But as a discard process, this stuff is really interesting because I suppose you could say that astronauts as a class are kind of venerated, like they're special people that have gone through extraordinary training and they live in space. They do these things that most of us are not able to do. So anything associated with them sort of takes on something of that special aura. And in the process of sending this stuff back to Earth, the deintegration crew also treats like the astronauts their personal belongings, their clothes, the souvenirs and mementos they've taken up to space to bring back and give to their family and clubs and organisations on Earth. They treat them with this incredible amount of care. So there's this interesting thing where those chosen objects receive a similar almost venerating treatment, but those very personal, intimate things to do with hygiene are treated as rubbish, as trash, as something slightly disgusting that needs to be burnt up. So there's all this stuff about boundaries between what's cultural, what's acceptable, all around the body of the astronaut. if you see what I mean. So we find this fascinating as well. Yeah.
No, I didn't realise how fascinating I'd find it as well until you explained it to me. There's some really interesting questions that that raises. I also just wanted to ask before we finish up, you know, if people are interested in space archaeology, where can they find out more about your work?
They could read my book, Dr. Space Junk versus the Universe, Archaeology in the Future, which was published in 2019. So that's fairly readily available online. I also have a blog called Space Age Archaeology, and there's numerous articles, some written for The Conversation, that are fairly easy to find. So, and if people want to get involved in space archaeology or have a career in it, there's a number of great universities in Australia with archaeology degrees, and that's a good starting place.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for chatting with me. Thank you for all of this new information that I've just absorbed into my brain. This is wonderful. I'm going to go about my day thinking of nothing but this now. Thanks so much for your time.
Thanks for having me, Ray.
That was space archaeologist Alice Gorman. Instagram Australia is bringing together some of the biggest names in the creator community in its first ever virtual festival, Instagram Next. Designed to empower and inspire creators with exclusive workshops and panels, Instagram Next is going to feature an epic lineup of top creators from Australia and New Zealand as well, like Dartham123 and Nick Topher, and they're going to share their insider experience and tips with other creators. Running across Thursday the 18th and Friday the 19th of November, the two-day event will be packed with practical sessions curated to help creators uncover their full potential in the creative space and as entrepreneurs, because the festival will cover topics including building resilience, handling social media burnout, you know, how to go from being gifted to getting paid, and also the anatomy of trends on Instagram. While this festival is invite only for the creator community and industry, select sessions and behind the scenes content from the 2 days are going to be shared on Instagram Australia's new dedicated account for local creators at Instagram Next AUS. IndigiLab is holding an IndigiHack, and it's all about merging First Nations culture, technology, and fashion. It's bringing together Indigenous fashion designers to design culturally appropriate, sustainable, and innovative tech solutions to fashion. I recently spoke with IndigiLab's CEO, Luke Briscoe, about this event, about IndigiLab, about his career in tech, and also the nuances of Indigenous science. So, Luke, what sparked your interest in tech?
Yeah, definitely. I've been really inspired by a lot of the technology that was used to really look at cultural mapping up in the north. When I was younger, I did a cultural mapping program with my uncle's corporation and learned a lot about the importance of how technology can be used to preserve and protect our culture. So yeah, really, that was really a grounding technically, I suppose. What really drew me into technology when I was a kid was I used to always tinker around with all the pickups on my guitar, so I needed to learn how to solder. So I got an uncle to teach me how to solder. So I'd redo these really cheap guitars and put Damasio pickups on it and all that stuff, you know, making it really flash. And then, yeah, like, I suppose for me, yeah, music was a way of connecting to technology, because had to keep up with the latest technology in music. And I also used to service a lot of musical instruments. And, you know, a lot of people find their own way into into science and technology. Yeah, definitely. I think music as a kid and culture combined really drew me into, more understanding more about technology and science.
In this podcast, we talk about arts as being a part of STEM, so it's STEAM. What resonance does that have for you? What place do you see arts having in the greater world of STEM?
Well, when I look at how we use these terms, STEAM and STEM, as Indigenous people, so I suppose for me, you really look at it as a rights-based approach because on one point there's, you know, science that's driven by Western agendas, and then there's Indigenous science, which is different again. So I think for me, what really drew me into needing to do more around the work in STEM, but also looking at how art can interlink, is actually the rights-based component to it, because the arts is where all of our culture and knowledge and the stories lie. So with art, you know, combining with STEM, it's vitally important because all of our stories are embedded in the arts already, and there's a lot of great work that has happened, you know, by people like Terry Jenkins and Lydia Miller, who have worked tirelessly to help build out more of the Indigenous cultural intellectual property rights within the arts sector. So the arts are vitally important to include into STEM because they've already really taken on that journey to understanding Indigenous rights within the arts. So those two combined really need to really look at a rights-based approach, I think, to science and technology for Indigenous people.
When we talk about Indigenous science, there's two ways that you can look at it. You can talk about, you know, Indigenous people working in science, and then there's Indigenous science. What is the difference there for you? I know that we've discussed this before.
Yeah, well, I think ultimately the difference is that Western science, for many years has evolved to really focusing on valuing the one person, whereas Indigenous science is more about collective voice around our knowledge systems. So when we look at this in a science space, the focus isn't just on, looking at in terms of getting your PhD. It's about looking at things like preserving the culture and the law of community science. So that's important, kind of a platform to really, look at how collective rights in science, can operate. So there are a lot of, in the last probably 10, 15 years, a lot of people moving into Indigenous people moving into science degrees. But it's important when we use these terms, Indigenous science, Indigenous scientists, we need to have a rights-based approach when we even talk about it, because when you think about it, Indigenous people aren't even included in the Constitution, and with that comes all of the alignment with business and all those other important economic and social drivers. But for Indigenous people, our science is a driver for us. But we're not even recognised in a constitution. There's no treaty, so we need to actually stand strong. And when we talk about these terms, Indigenous science, we need to not, focus on just getting Indigenous people into STEM careers, because to me that seems like that's a simulation. So what we need to do is really work collaboratively together to understand, well, what is Indigenous science to us? What we do at IndigiLab is we look at the four principles of the Declaration, and the first one is self-determination. So how does self-determination apply to things like saying Indigenous science when a project isn't actually focused on changing the culture of science? So there's these little nuances that we all need to think about, and we've been really trying to understand, how we can best do that. What I've come close to is something like well, you know, science sits in the domain of really trying to understand at the moment, understand the key drivers are for sustainable development goals. So we've been really working tirelessly to look at Indigenous cultural indicators to drive action on climate change. So then it means that if we are looking at Indigenous science, that there's a real understanding and purpose of what that science is about, not just about getting Indigenous peoples into science, but there's a mutual benefit for both parties, you know, to, because that's how I see us growing a startup sector, is to really focusing Indigenous science or, you know, looking at aligning Indigenous cultural indicators with the Sustainable Development Goals and, you know, really focusing, you know, on things like using our sciences for Indigenous sciences for environmental practices or, you know, moving our youth into programs like earth science or biology so then they can still maintain their stories and customs when they go through to university, but they're not going to be assimilated in a way that you know, they've, you know, forgotten the stories. You know, that's where I think there's a real big gap, you know, is making sure that when we talk about getting Indigenous peoples into careers in STEM, that, you know, there's a line, you know, like that you cross where you're assimilating.
Tell me about IndigiLab. Tell me about how you started this, why you started this.
Well, I suppose it goes back to what I mentioned earlier about, you know, my role with my uncle Bennett Corporation being included in the cultural keeping place program, and you know, that really stuck with me. You know, coming down to the city, and I worked at NITV, and I saw, you know, work in digital, and I saw that there needs to be more work done to protect Indigenous culture and knowledges, particularly online, and when we look at data sovereignty, and you know, look at you know, things like you know, what type of projects can Indigenous people create to have data sovereignty, to look at projects that looks at protecting our understanding and knowledge around ecosystems and the sciences involved with that. So IndigiLab really started out on a rights-based approach to looking at how Indigenous traditional knowledge can be protected and maintained in the science and technology space. It started out really during when there was a big science and innovation boom and in Australia, and almost 10 years ago, and, you know, we had this couple of summits and projects really to understand more about what the needs are for our communities. And you know, from the start, you know, of our foundations almost 10 years ago to now, we've really come to understand, you know, more about how we can develop these governance structures to protect Indigenous science. And I use Indigenous science as a way of asserting my rights as an Indigenous person.
So you've got a fashion hack coming up as part of IndigiLab. Can you tell me about that?
We have a fashion hack. It's on our IndigiHack.com page. And what it's about is about getting youth to be involved with a lot of these projects that look at sustainable development goals. A lot of the work I do with IndigiLab is trying to get kids to be involved in policy discussions and, you know, those big global debates. So the IndigiHack is set up particularly for that, to allow youth to really, you know, have these bigger discussions about, you know, what they can do to contribute to things like climate change. And so we've had this fashion hack idea for the last couple of years, and finally, yeah, City of Sydney has funded us to roll this project out. So how it works is, you know, you go to our portal online, and then you can submit an idea, you know, your concept and ideas. It doesn't have to be a fully worked prototype of a design. But what we're looking for with our fashion hack is the use of protecting your culture and knowledge within your design, or if you're working with an artist, making sure, you know, firstly that it's culturally appropriate, and then looking at the sustainability element to the designs and making sure that you've thought about your supply chain or thought about something that can really impact environmental sustainability. And then also looking at technology. So, you know, looking at what type of technologies you want to include. You can also go to our earthkin.online website, where you can purchase an eco-tech tech fashion kit. So then you can add your element to that if required. The fashion hack's really trying to get our youth to look at ways in which fashion, or, you know, as we know it as fast fashion, can really transfer into something that is more around sustainable fashion. And, you know, who best to drive initiatives like that than our youth? But we really have a focus on looking at streetwear fashion, because our youth and street fashion, you know, really doesn't get the credit it deserves as well, because a lot of the work of people that do in street fashion are usually minority groups that come up with these great innovations in fashion, but then when they you have a replica of it with Vogue, or you have some other high-end fashion taking little bits and pieces of our, street fashion. So I think about all those things, in fashion when I grew up, you would see a lot of the Samoans, they'd have the E-Lover Lovers around their baggy jeans and, all that type of stuff. You see that now in terms of looking at gender neutral fashion, and I just think, we're heading towards something that Michael Jackson wore in Remember the Time, it's like this whole rebranding of streetwear and indigenous ways of fashion and all this stuff, and to me, getting down to the roots of innovation really comes out down to innovating out of necessity. So our Indigenous communities have innovated out of necessity for thousands of years, and one way they're doing it now is through fashion and art. So, I think it's important for our youth to, take leadership around that. But also, test and try, just because that's what science is about, testing something and trying it. If it doesn't work, well, try it again. So, and that's what IndigiHack, aims to do, is inspire people just to participate and try something.
Absolutely. Now, if there are any young people listening that wanted to get into tech, do you have any advice for them?
Yeah, definitely. Go to our website, indigilab.com.au. We're also, in the new year, we're running a first coders academy for youth. In particular, so you can learn how to do coding with Indigenous coders, and then if you wanted to branch out into doing further coding programs with General Assembly or a TAFE or something like that, we'll provide those avenues for young coders. But also, particularly, go to our first coders .academy site as well, because there's very useful information about the importance of getting into coding first, because that's a real important skill that everyone needs to have at this point in time. But also, there needs to be a practical understanding about, you know, why you want to get into coding for, you know, for the starters. And that's what the First Coders Academy is all about, is about, you know, providing a relative kind of engagement for our youth to want to get into coding. So things like what we're going to be running is looking at gaming and coding. So, you know, we need to have more youth working in IT and getting IT skills. But I think doing our fundamental coding program will be vital for these kids to growing the sector, I think, or to getting kids into coding, but also through our programs. You know, it's run by Indigenous coders, so it's important that they see that, you know, that there's Indigenous people that are making waves in this space, and that, you know, they can work with them if they have any concerns around cultural matters, if they, you know, work in places like Google or Microsoft. So yeah, that's a really important platform that's launching in the new year, is First Coders Academy. So yeah, I think you know, both of those in DigiHack and First Coders Academy, yeah, like, we're really trying to get our youth involved with looking at how culture can really drive innovation and technology. And it starts with the youth, I think.
Absolutely. Well, thanks so much for your time, Luke. It's always great to hear from you.
Yeah, thanks, Ray. Thanks for having me on the show.
Anytime. That was IndigiLab's Luke Briscoe, and that brings us to the end of this first episode of STEAM. Please, if you enjoyed this episode, let me know. Give us a rating, share it with your friends, subscribe, and if there's anything STEAM related you'd like to know more about, hit me up on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, or LinkedIn at Ray Johnston, and I'll give you all the info in the next STEAM episode. See you then.